The first name he entered came back with multiple hits for drunk driving arrests. This didn't get Bosch particularly excited, but he circled the name on the list anyway and moved on. No hits came up on the next seven, and he crossed them out. The next name after that scored a hit with an arrest for disturbing the peace. Bosch circled it, but again was not feeling the tug of a hook yet. The process continued, with most of the names coming up clean. It wasn't until he entered the 29th name that Bosch looked at the screen and felt a tightness grip in his chest. The 29th name was Jonathan Gillespie. He had been described in the murder book as a dog breeder who sold miniature poodles in 1972. He had sold the dog Frenchie to June Wilkins 2 years before her death and was interviewed by Spiegelman and Finster when they were trying to run down the dog show angle on the case. According to the NCIC records, Gillespie went to prison on a rape charge in 1981 and served 6 years in prison. He was now a registered sexual offender living in Huntington Beach. There had been no other arrests since 1981. He was now 68 years old. Bosch underlined the name on the list and wrote down the case number. It had an LAPD prefix. Though he immediately wanted to go to work on Gillespie, he finished running the rest of the names through the NCIC database first. He got two more hits, one for a DUI and one for a hit-and-run accident with injuries. He circled the names to keep with his procedure, but was not excited about them. Before signing out of the NCIC system, he switched over to the crime tracking database and entered ketamine hydrochloride into the search window. He got several hits back, all within the last 15 years, and learned that the substance was being used increasingly as a date rape drug. He scrolled through the cases listed and didn't see anything that linked them to June Wilkins. He logged off the database to begin his pursuit of Jonathan Gillespie. Closed cases from 1981 had gone to microfiche archives, and the department was slowly moving backward and entering case information into the department's computerized database. But 1981 was too far back. The only way Bosch would be able to look at the sexual assault case that had sent Gillespie to prison would be to go to the records archives, which were housed over at Piper Tech, the storage facility and air squadron base at the edge of downtown. Bosch went to his side of the desk and wrote a note to Ryder telling her he had come up with a hot angle and was chasing it through Piper Tech. The phone on his desk started to ring. He finished the note and grabbed the phone while standing up to reach the note over to Ryder's desk. "Open on Solve, this is Bosch."
"Harry, it's Larkin."
"I was just going to call you."
"Really? Why?"
"I have a name for you."
"Funny, I have a name for you. And that's your palm, and you're not going to like it."
"Jonathan Gillespie."
"What?"
"Jonathan Gillespie."
"Who's that?"
"That's not your match."
"Not quite."
Bosch sat back down at his desk. He pulled a pad over in front of him and got ready to write. "Who did you come up with?"
"The palm print belonged to one of ours. Guy must have left it while at the crime scene. Sorry about that."
"Who is it?"
"The name is Ronald Eckersley. He worked for us 65 to 85, then he pulled the pin."
Bosch almost didn't hear anything else Larkin said.
"Shows that he was a patrol lieutenant upon retirement. You could go to personnel and get a current location if you need to talk to him. But it looks like he might have just screwed up and put his hand on the wall while he was at the scene. Back then, they didn't know anything about crime scene protocol, and some of these guys would... Hell, about 20 years ago, I was dusting a homicide scene, and one of the detectives who had been there all night started frying an egg in the dead guy's kitchen. He said he ain't gonna miss it, and I'm goddamn starved. You believe that? So no matter how hard you drill into them not to touch..."
"Thanks, Larkin," Bosch said. "I've got to go." Bosch hung up, grabbed the note off Ryder's desk, and crumpled it in his hand. He took his cell phone off his belt and called Ryder's cell number. She answered right away.
Where are you? Bosch asked.
Having a coffee.
You want to take a ride?
I've got the case summary to finish. Ride where?
10,000 palms.
Harry, that's not a ride. That's a journey. That's at least 90 minutes each way.
Get me a coffee for the road. I'll be right down.
He hung up before she could protest. On the drive out, Bosch told Ryder about the moves he had made with the case and how the print had come back to his old partner. He then recounted the morning he and Eckersley had found the lady in the tub. Ryder listened without interrupting. Then she had only one question at the end. "This is important, Harry," she said. "You are dealing with your own memory, and you know from case experience how faulty memories can be. We're talking 33 years ago. Are you sure there wasn't a moment when Eckersley could have put his hand on the wall?"
"Yeah, like he might have leaned against the wall and taken a leak while I didn't notice."
"I'm not talking about taking a leak. Could he have leaned against the wall when you found the body? Like he got grossed out or sick and leaned against the wall for sport?"
"No, kids. I was in that room the whole time he was. He said, 'Let's get out of here,' and he was the first one out. He did not go back in. We called in the detectives and then stood outside keeping the neighbors away when everybody showed up."
33 years is a long time, Harry.
Bosch waited a moment before responding. "I know this sounds sad and sick, but your first DB is like your first love. You remember the details. Plus..."
He didn't finish. "Plus what?"
"Plus my mother was murdered when I was a kid. I think it's why I became a cop. So finding that woman my second day on the job was sort of like finding my mother. I can't explain it. But what I can tell you is that I remember being in that house like it was yesterday. And Eckersley never touched a thing in there, let alone put his hand on the wall over the toilet." Now she was silent for a long moment before responding.
"Okay, Harry."
10,000 Palms was on the outskirts of Joshua Tree. They made good time and pulled into the visitor parking space in front of the tiny police station shortly before 1. They had worked out how they would handle Eckersley in the last half hour of the drive. They went in and asked a woman who was sitting behind a front counter if they could speak with Eckersley. They flashed the gold and told her they were from the Open Unsolved Unit. The woman picked up a phone and communicated the information to someone on the other end. Before she hung up, a door behind her opened, and there stood Ron Eckersley. He was thicker and his skin a dark and worn brown from the desert. He still had a full head of hair, which was cut short and silver. Bosch had no trouble recognizing him, but it didn't appear that he recognized Bosch.
"Detectives, come on back," he said.
He held the door, and they walked into his office. He was wearing a blue blazer with a maroon tie over a white shirt. It did not appear to Bosch that he had a gun on his belt. Maybe in a little desert town, a gun wasn't needed. The office was a small space with LAPD memorabilia and photographs on the wall behind the desk. Ryder introduced herself and shook Eckersley's hand, and then Bosch did the same. There was a hesitation in Eckersley's shake, and then Bosch knew. Instinctively, he knew. He was holding the hand of June Wilkins' killer.
"Harry Bosch," Eckersley said. "You were one of my boots, right?"
"That's right. I came on the job in 72. We rode Wilshire Patrol for 9 months.
"Imagine that. One of my boots coming back to see me."
"Actually, we want to talk to you about a case from 72, Ryder said. As planned, she took the lead. They took seats, and Bosch once again tried to determine if Eckersley was armed. There was no telltale bulge beneath the blazer. Ryder explained the case to Eckersley and reminded him that he and Bosch had been the patrol officers who discovered the body. She asked if he remembered the case at all. Eckersley leaned back in his desk chair, his jacket falling to his sides and revealing no holster or weapon on his belt. He looked for an answer on the ceiling. Finding nothing, he leaned forward and shook his head.
"I'm drawing a blank, detectives," he said. "And I'm not sure why you would come all the way out here to ask an old patrol dog about a DB. My guess is we were in and out, and we cleared the way for the dicks. Isn't that right, partner?"
He looked at Bosch, his last word a reminder that they had once protected each other's back.
"Yes, we were in and out."
"But we have information, newly developed information, that you apparently had a relationship with the victim," Ryder said matter-of-factly, "and that this relationship was not brought to light during the initial investigation."
Eckersley looked closely at her, wondering how to read the situation. Bosch knew this was the pivotal moment. If Eckersley were to make a mistake, it would be now.
"What information?" Eckersley asked.
"We are not at liberty to discuss it, Chief," Ryder responded. "But if you have something to tell us now. It would be best for you to clear this up before we go down the road with it."
Eckersley's face cracked into a smile, and he looked at Bosch.
"This is a joke, right? Bosch, you're putting her up to this, right?"
Bosch shook his head.
"No joke," Bosch said. "You're in a spot here, Chief."
Eckersley shook his head as if not comprehending the situation.
"You said open unsolved, right? That's cold case stuff. DNA.
This a DNA case?"
Bosch felt things tumbling into place. Eckersley had made the mistake. He had taken the bait and was fishing for information. It wasn't what an innocent man would do. Ryder felt it too. She leaned toward his desk.
"Chief, do you mind if I give you a rights warning before we go further with this?"
"Oh, come on," Eckersley protested. "You can't be serious. What relationship?"
Ryder read Eckersley the standard Miranda rights warning from a card she had pulled out of a pocket in her blazer.
"Chief Eckersley, do you understand your rights as I read them?"
"Of course I understand them. I've only been a cop for 40 years. What the hell is going on here?"
"What's going on is that we are giving you the opportunity to explain the relationship you had with this woman. If you choose not to cooperate, then it's not going to work out well for you."
"I told you there was no relationship, and you can't prove there was. That body had been in that tub for a week. From what I heard, it practically came apart when they were taking it out of there. You got no DNA. Nobody even knew about DNA back then."
Ryder made a quick glance toward Bosch, and this was her signal that he could step in if he wanted. He did.
"You worked Wilshire for 4 years before that morning," Bosch said.
"Did you meet her on patrol, when she was out walking the dog? Where did you meet her, Chief?"
"You told me you were working solo for 4 months before I was put in the car with you.
Is that when you met her? When you were out working alone?"
Eckersley angrily grabbed the phone off its cradle on his desk.
"I still know some people at Parker Center. I'm going to see if they are aware of what you two people are doing. Coming to my office to accuse me of this crap."
"If you call anyone, you better call your lawyer," Bosch said. Eckersley slammed the phone back down into its cradle.
"What do you want from me? I did not know that woman, just like you. I saw her for the first time floating with her dog in the bathtub. First and last time. And I got out of there as fast as I goddamn could."
"And you never went back in?"
"That's right, Boot. I never went back in." "There. They had him."
"Then how come your palm print was on the wall over the toilet?" Eckersley froze. Bosch read his eyes. He remembered the moment he had put his hand on the wall. He knew they had him. Eckersley glanced out of the office's only window. It was to his left, and it offered a view of a fire department equipment yard. He then looked back at Bosch and spoke in a quiet voice.
"You know how often I wondered when somebody like you would show up here? How many years I've been waiting?"
Bosch nodded. "It must have been a burden," he said without sympathy.
"She wanted more. She wanted something permanent," Eckersley said. "Christ, she was 15 years older than me. She was just a patrol pal,
That's what we called them. But then she got the wrong idea about things, and when I had to set her straight, she said she was going to make a complaint about me. She was going to go to the captain. I was married back then. I couldn't. He said nothing else. His eyes were downcast. He was looking at the memory. Bosch could put the rest of it together. Eckersley hatched a plan that would throw the investigation off, send it in the wrong direction. His only mistake was the moment he put his hand on the wall over the toilet.
"You have to come with us now, Chief," Ryder said.
She stood up. Eckersley looked up at her.
"With you?" he said.
"No, I don't." With his right hand, he pulled open the desk drawer in front of him and quickly reached in with his left. He withdrew a black steel pistol and brought it up to his neck.
"No!"
Ryder yelled. Eckersley pressed the muzzle deep into the left side of his neck. He angled the weapon upward and pulled the trigger. The weapon's contact against his skin muffled the blast. His head snapped back, and blood splattered across the wall of police memorabilia behind him. Bosch never moved in his seat. He just watched it happen. Pretty soon, the woman from the front counter came running in, and she screamed and held her hands up to her mouth. Bosch turned and looked at Ryder. "That was a long time coming," he said. Laura was already rented at Eddie's Saturday matinee, so Bosch rented Sharky's machine instead. He watched it at home that night while drinking beer and eating peanut butter sandwiches, and trying to keep his mind away from what had happened in Eckersley's office. It wasn't a bad movie, though he could see almost everything coming. Burt Reynolds and Bernie Casey made pretty good cops, and Rachel Ward was the call girl with a heart of gold. Bosch saw what Burt saw in her. He thought he could easily fall in love with her, too, call girl or not, dead or alive. Near the end of the movie, there was a shootout, and Bernie Casey got wounded. Bleeding and out of bullets, he used a Zen mantra to make himself invisible to the approaching shooter. It worked. The shooter walked right by him, and Bernie lived to tell about it. Bosch liked that. At the end of the movie, he remembered that moment the best. He wished there were a Zen chant he could use now, so Ronald Eckersley could just walk on by him, too. But he knew there was no such thing. Eckersley would take his place with the others that came to him at night. The ones he remembered. Bosch thought about calling Kiz and telling her what he thought of the movie, but he knew it was too late and she would get upset with him. He killed the TV instead and turned off the lights.
This has been an Hachette Audio production of Angle of Investigation, written by Michael Connelly. Read by Len Carew. Executive Producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Post-production by Jennifer Nix and John Kovarik. Angle of Investigation is also available in print and as an ebook from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2011 by Hieronymus Incorporated. Audio production copyright 2011 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
The following is an excerpt from the opening pages of The Drop. Chapter 1. Christmas came once a month in the open unsolved unit.
That was when the lieutenant made her way around the squad room like Santa Claus, parceling out the assignments like presents to the squad's six detective teams. The cold hits were the lifeblood of the unit. The teams didn't wait for call-outs and fresh kills in Open Unsolved. They waited for cold hits. The Open Unsolved unit investigated unsolved murders going back 50 years in Los Angeles. There were 12 detectives, a secretary, a squad room supervisor known as the Whip, and the lieutenant. And there were 10,000 cases. The first five detective teams split up the 50 years, each pair taking 10 randomly chosen years. Their task was to pull all the unsolved homicide cases from their assigned years out of the archives, evaluate them, and submit long-stored and forgotten evidence for reanalysis with contemporary technology. All DNA submissions were handled by the new regional lab out at Cal State. When DNA from an old case was matched to an individual whose genetic profile was carried in any of the nation's DNA databases, it was called a cold hit. The lab put cold hit notices in the mail at the end of every month. They would arrive a day or two later at the police administration building in downtown Los Angeles. Usually by 8 a.m. that day, the lieutenant would open the door of her private office and enter the squad room. She carried the envelopes in her hand. Each hit sheet was mailed individually in a yellow business envelope. Generally, the envelopes were handed to the same detectives who had submitted the DNA evidence to the lab. But sometimes there were too many cold hits for one team to handle at once. Sometimes detectives were in court or on vacation or leave, and sometimes the cold hits revealed circumstances that required the utmost finesse and experience. That was where the sixth team came in. Detectives Harry Bosch and David Chu were the sixth team. They were floaters. They handled overflow cases and special investigations. On Monday morning, October 3rd, Lieutenant Gail Duvall stepped out of her office and into the squad room, carrying only three yellow envelopes. Harry Bosch almost sighed at the sight of such a paltry return on the squad's DNA submissions. He knew that with so few envelopes, he would not be getting a new case to work. Bosch had been back in the unit for almost a year following a two-year reassignment to Homicide Special. But coming back for his second tour of duty in Open Unsolved, he had quickly fallen into the rhythm of the squad. It wasn't a fly squad. There was no dashing out the door to get to a crime scene. In fact, there were no crime scenes. There were only files and archive boxes. It was primarily an 8-to-4 gig with an asterisk, that asterisk being that there was more travel than with other detective squads. People who got away with murder, or at least thought they had, tended not to stick around. They moved elsewhere, and often the OU detectives had to travel to retrieve them. A big part of the rhythm was the monthly cycle of waiting for the yellow envelopes to come out. Sometimes Bosch found it hard to sleep during the nights leading up to Christmas. He never took time off during the first week of the month and never came to work late if there was a chance that the yellow envelopes were in. Even his teenage daughter noticed his monthly cycle of anticipation and agitation and had likened it to a menstrual cycle. Bosch didn't see the humor in this and was embarrassed when she brought it up. Now his disappointment at the sight of so few envelopes in the lieutenant's hand was something palpable in his throat. He wanted a new case. He needed a new case. He needed to see the look on the killer's face when he knocked on the door and showed his badge, the embodiment of unexpected justice come calling after so many years. It was addictive, and Bosch was craving it now. The lieutenant handed the first envelope to Rick Jackson. He and his partner, Rich Bengston, were solid investigators who had been with the unit since its inception. Bosch had no complaint there. The next envelope was placed on an empty desk belonging to Teddy Baker. She and her partner, Greg Keough, were on their way back from a pickup in Tampa, Florida. An airline pilot who had been connected through fingerprints to the 1991 strangulation of a flight attendant in Brentwood. Bosch was about to suggest to the lieutenant that Baker and Keough might have their hands full with the Brentwood case, and that the envelope should be given to another team, namely his. When the lieutenant looked at him and used the last remaining envelope to beckon him to her office. "Can you guys step in for a minute? You too, Tim?" Tim Marcia was the squad whip, the detective three who handled mostly supervisory and fill-in duties in the squad. He mentored the young detectives and made sure the old ones, like Jackson and Bosch, didn't get lazy. Bosch was up out of his seat before the lieutenant had finished her question. He headed toward the lieutenant's office with Chu and Marcia trailing behind. "Close the door," Duval said. "Sit down." Duval had a corner office with windows that looked across Spring Street at the Los Angeles Times building. Paranoid that reporters were watching from the newsroom across the way, Duval kept her blinds permanently closed. It made the office dim and cave-like. Bosch and Chu took the two seats positioned in front of the lieutenant's desk. Marcia followed them in, moved to the side of Duval's desk, and leaned against an old evidence safe. "I want you two to handle this hit," she said, proffering the yellow envelope to Bosch. "There's something wrong there, and I want you to keep quiet about it until you find out what it is. Keep Tim in the loop, but keep it low-key." The envelope had already been opened. Chu leaned over to look as Harry opened the flap and pulled out the hit sheet. It listed the case number for which DNA evidence had been submitted, plus the name, age, last known address, and criminal history of the person whose genetic profile matched it. Bosch first noticed that the case number had an 89 prefix, meaning it was a case from 1989. There were no details about the crime, just the year. But Bosch knew that 1989 cases belonged to the team of Ross Schuler and Adriana Dolan. He knew this because 1989 had been a busy year for him, working murders for the homicide special team, and he had recently checked on one of his own unsolved cases, learning that jurisdiction over cases from that year belonged to Schuler and Dolan. They were known in the unit as the Kids. They were young, passionate, and very skillful investigators, but between them, they had less than 8 years' experience working homicides. If there was something unusual about this cold hit, it would not be surprising that the lieutenant would want Bosch on it. Bosch had worked more killings than everybody in the unit combined. That is, if you took out Jackson. He had been around forever. Bosch next studied the name on the hit sheet. Clayton S. Pell. It meant nothing to him. But Pell's record included numerous arrests and three separate convictions for indecent exposure, false imprisonment, and forcible rape. He had spent 6 years in prison for the rape before being released 18 months earlier. He had a 5-year probation tail, and his last known address came from the State Probation and Parole Board. He was living at a halfway house for sexual offenders in Panorama City. Based on Pell's record, Bosch believed the 1989 case was likely a sex-related murder. He could feel his insides beginning to tighten. He was going to go out and grab Clayton Pell and bring him to justice.
"Do you see it?" Duval asked.
"See what?" Bosch asked. "Was this a sex killing? This guy has the classic predator."
"The birth date," Duval said.
Bosch looked back down at the hit sheet as Chu leaned over further. "Yeah, right here," Bosch said. "November 9, 1981. What's that got—"
"He's too young," Chu said.
Bosch glanced at him and then back down at the sheet. He suddenly got it. Clayton Pell was born in 1981. He was only 8 years old at the time of the murder on the hit sheet.
"Exactly," Duval said. "So I want you to get the book and box from Schuler and Dolan and very quietly figure out what we have here. I'm hoping to God they didn't get two cases mixed up. Bosch knew that if Schuler and Dolan had somehow sent in genetic material from the old case, labeled under a more recent case, then both cases would be tainted, beyond any hope of prosecution. As you were about to say, Duval continued, this guy on the hit sheet is no doubt a predator, but I don't think he got away with a killing when he was only 8 years old. So something doesn't fit. Find it, and come back to me before you do anything. If they screwed up and we can correct it, then we won't need to worry about IAD or anybody else. We'll just keep it right here. She may have appeared to be trying to protect Schuler and Dolan from internal affairs, but she was also protecting herself, and Bosch knew it. There would not be much vertical movement in the department for a lieutenant who had presided over an evidence handling scandal in her own unit. What other years are assigned to Schuler and Dolan? Bosch asked.
On the recent side, they've got 97 and 2000, Marcia said. This could have come from a case they were working from one of those 2 years.
Bosch nodded. He could see the scenario. The reckless handling of genetic evidence from one case cross-pollinates with another. The end result would be two tainted cases and scandal that would splash anybody near it. What do we say to Schuler and Dolan? Chu asked. What's the reason we're taking the case off them?
Duval looked up at Marcia for an answer.
They've got a trial coming up, he offered. Jury selection starts Thursday.
Duval nodded. I'll tell them I want them clear for that.
And what if they say they still want the case? Chu asked.
What if they say they can handle it?
I'll put them straight, Duval said. Anything else, detectives?
Bosch looked up at her. We'll work the case, Lieutenant, and see what's what. But I don't investigate other cops.
That's fine. I'm not asking you to. Work the case and tell me how the DNA came back to an 8-year-old kid, okay?
Bosch nodded and started to stand up.
Just remember, Duval added, you talk to me before you do anything with what you learn.
You got it, Bosch said. They were about to leave the room.
Harry, the lieutenant said, hang back a second.
Bosch looked at Chu and raised his eyebrows. He didn't know what this was about. The lieutenant came around from behind her desk and closed the door after Chu and Marcia had left. She stayed standing and businesslike.
I just wanted you to know that your application for an extension on your drop came through. They gave you 4 years retroactive.
Bosch looked at her, doing the math. He nodded. He had asked for the maximum, 5 years non-retroactive, but he'd take what they gave. It wouldn't keep him much past high school, but it was better than nothing.
Well, I'm glad, Duval said. It gives you 39 more months with us.
Her tone indicated that she had read disappointment in his face. No, he said quickly. I'm glad. I was just thinking about where that would put me with my daughter. It's good. I'm happy.
Good, then.
That was her way of saying the meeting was over. Bosch thanked her and left the office. As he stepped back into the squad room, he looked across the vast expanse of desks and dividers and file cabinets. He knew it was home, and that he would get to stay. For now. Chapter 2 The open-on-solve unit shared access to the 3 fifth-floor conference rooms with all the other units in the robbery-homicide division. Usually, detectives had to reserve time in one of the rooms, signing on the clipboard hooked on the door. But this early on a Monday, all of them were open, and Bosch, Chu, Schuler, and Dolan commandeered the smallest room without making a reservation. They brought with them the murder book and the small archival evidence box from the 1989 case.
Okay, Bosch said, when everyone was seated. So you are cool with us running with this case? If you're not, we can go back to the lieutenant and say you really want to work it.
No, it's okay, Schuler said. We're both involved in the trial, so it's better this way.
It's our first case in the unit, and we want to see it through to that guilty verdict.
Bosch nodded as he casually opened the murder book. You want to give us the rundown on this one, then? Schuler gave Dolan a nod, and she began to summarize the 1989 case as Bosch flipped through the pages of the binder.
We have a 19-year-old victim named Lily Price, student from Ohio, good all-around kid. She was snatched off the street while walking home from the beach to her apartment in Venice on a Sunday afternoon. At the time, they narrowed the grab point down to the vicinity of Speedway and Voyage. Price lived on Voyage with three roommates. One was with her on the beach, and two were in the apartment. She disappeared between those two points. She said she was going back to use the bathroom, and she never made it.
She left her towel and a Walkman on the beach, Schuler said. Sunscreen. So it was clear she was intending to come back. She never did. And her two roommates in the apartment said she never showed up there either.
Her body was found the next morning on the rocks down at the cut, Dolan said. She was naked and had been raped and strangled. Her clothes were never found. The ligature was removed.
Bosch flipped through several plastic pages containing faded Polaroid shots of the crime scene. Looking at the victim, he couldn't help but think of his own daughter, who at 15 had a full life in front of her. There had been a time when looking at photos like this fueled him, gave him the fire he needed to be relentless. But since Maddie had come to live with him, it was increasingly difficult for him to look at victims. It didn't stop him from building the fire, however. Where did the DNA come from? He asked. Semen?
No, the killer used a condom or didn't ejaculate, Dolan said. No semen.
It came from a small smear of blood, Schuler said. It was found on her neck, right below the right ear. She had no wounds in that area. It was assumed that it had come from the killer, that he had been cut, or maybe was already bleeding. It was just a drop, a smear, really. She was strangled with a ligature. If she was strangled from behind, then his hand could have been against her neck there. If there was a cut on his hand...
Transfer deposit, Chu said.
Exactly.
Bosch found the Polaroid that showed the victim's neck and the smear of blood. The photo was washed out by time, and he could barely see the blood. A ruler had been placed on the girl's neck so that the blood smear could be measured in the photo. It was less than an inch long.
So this blood was collected and stored, he said, a statement meant to draw further explanation. Yes, Schuler said. Because it was a smear, it was swabbed. Back then they typed it, O positive. The swab was stored in a tube, and we found it still in property when we pulled the case. The blood had turned to powder.
He tapped the top of the archive box with a pen.
Bosch's phone started to vibrate in his pocket. Normally he would let the call go to message, but his daughter was homesick from school and alone. He needed to make sure she wasn't calling. He pulled the phone out of his pocket and glanced at the screen. It wasn't his daughter. It was a former partner, Kismen Ryder, now a lieutenant assigned to the OCP, Office of the Chief of Police. He decided he would return her call after the meeting. They had lunch together about once a month, and he assumed she was free today or calling because she had heard about his drop application getting approved. He shoved the phone back into his pocket.
Did you open the tube? He asked.
Of course not, Schuler said.
Okay, so 4 months ago you sent the tube containing the swab and what was left of the blood out to the regional lab, right? He asked.
That's right, Schuler said.
Bosch flipped through the murder book to the autopsy report. He was acting like he was more interested in what he was seeing than what he was saying.
And at that time, did you submit anything else to the lab?
From the Price case? Dolan asked. No, that was the only biological evidence they came up with back at the time.
Bosch nodded, hoping she would keep talking.
But back then, it didn't lead to anything, she said.
They never came up with a suspect. Who'd they come up with on the cold hit?
We'll get to that in a second, Bosch said. What I meant was, did you submit to the lab from any other cases you were working? Or was this all you had going?
No, that was it, Schuler said, his eyes squinting in suspicion. What's going on here, Harry?
Bosch reached into his inside coat pocket and pulled out the hit sheet. He slid it across the table to Schuler.
The hit comes back to a sexual predator who would look real good for this except for one thing.
Schuler unfolded the sheet, and he and Dolan leaned together to read it, just as Bosch and Chu had earlier.
What's that? Dolan said, not picking up on the significance of the birth date yet. This guy looks perfect.
He's perfect now, Bosch said, but back then, he was only 8 years old.
You're kidding, Dolan said.
What the fuck? Schuler added.
Dolan pulled the sheet away from her partner, as if to see it clearer, and to double-check the birth date. Schuler leaned back and looked at Bosch with those suspicious eyes.
So you think we fucked up and mixed up cases, he said.
Nope, Bosch said. The lieutenant asked us to check out the possibility, but I don't see any fuck-up on this end.
So it happened at the lab, Schuler said. Do you realize that if they screwed things up at regional, every defense lawyer in the county is going to be able to raise doubt about DNA matches that come out of there?
Yeah, I kind of figure that, Bosch said. Which is why you should keep this under your hats until we know what happened. There are other possibilities.
Dolan held up the hit sheet.
Yeah, what if there is no fuck-up anywhere in the line? What if it's really this kid's blood on that dead girl?
An 8-year-old boy snatches a 19-year-old girl off the street, rapes and strangles her, and dumps the body 4 blocks away? Chu asked.
Never happened. Well, maybe he was there, Dolan said. Maybe this was how he got his start, as a predator. You see his record? This guy fits.
Except for his age.
Bosch nodded.
Maybe, he said. As I said, there are other possibilities. No reason to panic yet.
His phone started to vibrate again. He pulled it and saw it was Kiz Ryder again. 2 calls in 5 minutes. He decided he'd better take it. This wasn't about lunch.
I have to step out for a second.
He got up and answered the call as he stepped out of the conference room into the hallway.
Kiz?
Harry, I've been trying to get to you with a heads up.
I'm in a meeting. What heads up?
You are about to get a forthwith from the OCP.
You want me to come up to 10?
In the new PAB, the chief's suite of offices was on the 10th floor, complete with a private courtyard balcony that looked out across the Civic Center. No, Sunset Strip. You're going to be told to go to a scene and take over a case. And you're not going to like it.
Look, Lieutenant, I just got a case this morning. I don't need another one.
He thought that using her formal title would communicate his wariness. Forthwiths and assignments out of the OCP always carried high jingle, political overtones. It was sometimes hard to navigate your way through it.
He's not going to give you a choice here, Harry.
He being the chief of police. What's the case?
A jumper at the Chateau Marmont.
Who was it?
Harry, I think you should wait for the chief to call you. I just wanted to...
Who was it, Kiz? If you know anything about me, I think you know I can keep a secret until it's no longer a secret.
She paused before answering. From what I understand, there is not a lot that is recognizable. He came down 7 floors onto concrete. But the initial ID is George Thomas Irving, age 46 of age.
Irving as in Irvin Irving? As in Councilman Irvin Irving?
Bosch knew that a case that had involved the OCP so quickly had to have political overtones. The name Irving now made that connection obvious.
Yes, one and the same, Ryder said. Scourge of the LAPD in general, and one Detective Harry Bosch in particular. It's his son, and Councilman Irving has insisted to the chief that you take over the investigation. The chief said no problem.
Bosch paused with his mouth open for a moment before responding. Why does Irving want me? He spent most of his careers in police and politics trying to end mine.
This I don't know, Harry. I only know that he wants you.
When did this come in?
The call came in at about 5:45 this morning. My understanding is that it is unclear when it actually happened.
Bosch checked his watch. The case was more than 3 hours old. That was quite late to be coming into a death investigation. He'd be starting out at a disadvantage.
What's to investigate? He said. You said it was a jumper.
Hollywood originally responded, and we're going to wrap it up as a suicide. The councilman arrived and is not ready to sign off on that. That's why he wants you.
And does the chief understand that I have a history with Irving? That...
Yes, he does. He also understands that he needs every vote he can get on the council if we ever want to get overtime flowing to the department again.
Bosch saw his boss, Lieutenant Duval, enter the hallway from the open-on-solve unit's door. She made a there-you-are gesture and started toward him.
Looks like I'm about to get the official word, Bosch said into the phone. Thanks for the warning, kids. Doesn't make any sense to me, but thanks. If you hear anything else, let me know.
Harry, you be careful with this. Irving's old, but he's still got teeth.
I know that.
Keep in touch.
You got it. Bosch closed his phone just as Duval got to him, holding out a piece of paper.
Sorry, Harry. Change of plans. You and Chu need to go to this address and take a live case.
What are you talking about? Bosch looked at the address. It was the Chateau Marmont.
Orders from the chief's office. You and Chu are to proceed Code 3 and take over a case. That's all I know. That, and that the chief himself is there waiting.
What about the case you just gave us?
Move it to the back burner for now. I want you on it, but just get to it when you can.
She pointed to the piece of paper in his hand.
That's the priority.
You sure about this, Lieutenant?
Of course I'm sure. The chief called me directly, and he's going to call you. So grab Chu and get going.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.